Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Let me start with the association. Let me start with that matchup in what could be a preview of the Western Conference Finals in the NBA. Let's hope not. I mean, I don't mind that being the matchup, but let's hope for something more competitive than we got last night because the Lakers looked gassed. Actually, they looked gassed earlier in the week. They looked gassed in that overtime loss to the Wizards on Monday. So the last place you want to be gassed right about now is Salt Lake City. Because if so, the Jazz are going to carve you. And that's exactly what happened last night. Utah 114, LA 89, a complete hospital job. And you had to know that was coming. No way the Lakers busted up the way they are right now. We're going to hang with this Jazz team. That game was over before halftime. The best thing about the Lakers getting waxed that badly, and you know me, I'm always looking for the positive in things. The best thing there is LeBron actually got off his feet and he got some rest. Just don't tell me you were surprised by anything you saw last night from either team. Because, well, how you play in February doesn't mean a hell of a lot, especially if you're the defending champs. And especially if you're a team that has yet to prove that you can get it done in the postseason. Despite that fact, these are still two teams headed in different directions right now. The Lakers have lost four in a row. They've lost five of their last six. The Jazz, meanwhile, have won 22 of their last 24, and they're shooting the hell out of it. They're doing everything right. They're building a monster in Salt Lake. And while they might not have the star power of the Lakers or the Clippers or the Nets, and they haven't done it yet in the postseason, I'm going to say to you that sleeping on these guys would not be smart. Not smart at all, because that's a damn good team. It's a damn good team with a couple of all-stars in Rudy Gobert and Donovan Mitchell. Those two all-stars who are both still ascending, but that's not even where I want to start. No, I want to start with Michael Alex Conley Jr. Yesterday, it was announced that Devin Booker would be taking the place of Anthony Davis on the All-Star team, which meant that Mike Conley would not be getting that spot. Look, I'm not going to waste time arguing about All-Star snubs. I don't give a damn about that. I never have. I never will. But I will say this. Conley deserves to be an All-Star. And if he ends up playing his entire career without going to a single All-Star game, that would be a freaking crime. Because he is that good. And he came out to prove it in the first 45 seconds last night.
Offensive rebound by Mitchell off the O'Neal miss. Here's Conley, who has played very well, shooting a career-high 41% from three-point land. Conley with a steal and five quick ones. Conley ends up wide open. Hits the three, and Conley off to a great start.
That's ESPN. He was off to a great start. Pull up three, get the steal, then go for an easy layup on the first minute. And then he chases that with another 3 minutes later. All this guy does is make an impact on both ends. And he makes it look easy. 14 points, 8 assists, 8 rebounds, 2 steals. And it looks like the guy's not even trying at all. Actually, that's what the entire Utah Jazz look like to me right now. A team that's not even trying at all. They make it look so easy. Like, everybody knows about their defense. And yes, they did lock the Lakers up last night. Held them to 40% shooting, 24% beyond the arc. We've come to expect that from the Jazz. But they, again, absolutely shoot the hell out of it. And they move the ball so well. And they move so well without the ball. And they're so well coached. They find the open man knocks down shots, and they make the game look easy. Insane enough that they've ripped off 22 of their last 24, but even more insane when you consider 20 of those wins have been by double digits. So they're not just beating teams, they're beating the crap out of them. And they're doing it every time they take the floor. So if you run with these guys now, odds are you're going to get humiliated, no matter who you are. Ask the Lakers. That's exactly what happened to them last night. I'm telling you, it's how they do it. That's so mind-blowing. Like, kind of crazy that you can put 114 up on somebody, and yet your leading scorer only has 18. How is that possible in this day and age that an NBA team can put up 114 and nobody gets above 20? How can you blow out the defending champs on a night where your star player goes 4 for 16 with 13 points? Well, how? Because they had six guys scoring at least 12. You want to talk about strength in numbers? They're that deep with that many playmakers and that many scorers. And that's what makes this team so interesting and so dangerous. Because for a long time now, the conventional thinking in the NBA is, or was, in order to win a ring, you need superstars. And not just one, and maybe not just two. But the Jazz are challenging that notion. Because they don't hit you with the so-called generational talent. They may not have that so-called transcendent superstar. But they do have stars. Stars in Mitchell, Gobert, Conley. And Donovan Mitchell can do things like this.
Left side, Donovan. They're switching everything. Donovan beats Wesley to the rack. Cocks the right hand and hammers. Oh, Donovan. Wow. Timeout because I got to check and make sure the rim is still attached to the glass.
Oh, Jazz Radio. Because Donovan can do that and Donovan can do this.
Stolen. Donovan, lob it. Gobert.
Gobert, Jazz TV. Remember when there were actually dopes who were questioning how good Donovan Mitchell actually is and what he could bring to a team if he didn't score the ball? Yeah, well, he didn't score last night, and he still had 8 assists and 10 boards. So they do have stars. And they do have numbers, and they do have guys who can shoot it lights out from deep. And last night they were locked in. 22 threes, 46% from deep. And last night's 22 bombs gave them 50 in their last two games, which is an NBA record. Now me, I'm no analytics wizard, but if you're holding your opposition to 24% from three, and you're hitting 46% of your own from three, I like your chances. In fact, I like them a lot. And so does Rudy Gobert.
When you have a team of shooters like we do, it can go pretty fast.
Right? Or Gobert put it even more succinctly.
We know we can score. We know we can score anytime.
Right. So what I'm saying is, believe this, the Jazz are the proverbial problem now. The Jazz are a problem. And those who know, know. Those who know are not talking crap about these guys. Those who know that they're probably going to end up with the number one seed in the West. And that if you want a shot at a ring, you're going to have to go through the Jazz. Those who know that it's no longer a matter of the Jazz having to just deal with the Lakers or the Clippers or the Nets if they come out of the East. Those who know that all of these contenders have to deal with the Jazz too. No. I'm not crowning their ass just yet. I want to be very clear about that. I'm not doing that. But I am saying this. The Jazz are good enough to not only contend, but to win it all. And they're good enough to do it this season. They're no joke. In fact, they're a problem. A big freaking problem. You got Bogdan going 5-for-8 from three-point range. You got Jordan Clarkson and his revenge tour dropping 17 off the bench. And again, let me circle all the way back and end this opening rant by pointing out Mike Conley. I'm not surprised he made 4 threes on 6 attempts. I'm shocked that he missed any of his threes. We all saw his home gym last year during that horse competition. My man's gym at home is better than most NBA arenas. Why aren't the Jazz playing their home games at Conley's home? That's where they should play their home games. Are you feeling stressed out? Probably so. Most people are. Listen, don't let the stress of daily life weigh on your body. Whether you're an elite athlete or somebody like me, just trying to make it through the day tension-free, Theragun can help. Theragun is the handheld percussive therapy device that releases your deepest muscle tension using a scientifically calibrated combo of depth, speed, and power. And it's as quiet as an electric toothbrush. This product is incredible. The Gen 4 Theragun doesn't just feel good, it gets to the source of the pain by releasing tension using Theragun's signature percussive therapy, which goes 60% deeper than vibration alone. Whether you want to treat your muscle tension from working out, or maybe you have an injury, or it's just the stresses of everyday life, there is no substitute for the Theragun Gen 4. Theragun is trusted by 250 professional sports teams like Real Madrid and elite athletes like Paul George, DeAndre Hopkins, Maria Sharapova, hundreds of thousands of customers, and myself. I have mine. I absolutely love this product. Try Theragun for 30 days, starting at only $199. Go to Theragun.com/Rome right now and get your Gen 4 Theragun today. This product is sensational. Go to Theragun.com/Rome right now. Get your Gen 4 Theragun today. The product is absolutely amazing. Once again, Theragun.com/Rome, R-O-M-E. Theragun.com/Rome. Porter Moser is my guest. Porter, it's been a minute or two since you and I last spoke. It's great to have you back. How are you doing? How is your life right now?
Jim, great being on. Good talking to you again. And things are good. I love that we're in late February playing for a championship game again, and I love it's four straight years we're right there playing for a championship, and so we're right where we want to be heading into March, you know, playing good and being having a chance to get back to the tournament.
You actually took my line. I was going to say you're right where you want to be, and that's true. All right, so you beat Valpo last Wednesday in a game that came right down to the wire. You called that a Valley Pride game. What do you mean by that, and then how significant is it to get a Valley Pride win?
Well, I tell you what it was is the Valley every night. It's just been one of those leagues. It's always like ranked around the 10th best league in the country. It's a great basketball league. But we played back-to-back nights on Saturday, Sunday against Drake, who they're also been in the top 25. And it was an emotional weekend. We had the highs of winning by 27 on Saturday and then the lows of losing a one-point overtime on Sunday. Had to come back, fly back, get back on Monday when the guys, they're dead-ass tired, and, you know, you had to prepare for Valpo on Wednesday, and we just kind of gutted it out. And that also is a byproduct of sometimes you come home and your crowd can kind of pick you up when you're a little flat. Well, in Chicago, like, we were not allowed anybody. It's crickets. And we were a little flat, and we just gutted it out. And you need to do that. You need to do that. You need to – because you can reference that later on down the stretch of finding ways to win when you're not completely on. And I think that's a great thing that came out of that game. And it was just a very tough, tough game when we were a little bit flat and found a way to be good at the end.
Porter Moser is my guest. I love that reference. Like, you can look at it a couple of ways. You were either a little bit flat or you were dead-ass tired, which I love. I love that phrase. And then you found a way to get it done. Now, you've got Cameron Krutwig, who was a big part of that Final Four run in 2018. As a freshman, he's now a strong candidate for Conference Player of the Year. What does he mean to the team now, and how much has he grown as a player?
You know, he came in as he was starting for us as a freshman, and he was a piece of that puzzle, but he didn't have to lead. He had some other guys, some guards that were, you know, Clayton Custer, Marcus Towns, who both ended up being players of the year themselves. And then now it's his team. He's a leader. And you don't see a lot in college basketball that the vocal leader is your center. Centers are usually just big old dudes, you know, kind of quiet, just following along. He's the loudest guy in the gym every day. He's like that 5'5 walk-on who's slapping everybody on the butt in practice every day. And he means everything to us. And Jim, I don't know if you remember this, but we also spoke, right, like on that show. It was, and you said it. Some other people said it. Like, a lot of times mid-major guys, you know, they win and they jump and take the money and they run. And Krutwig's been a guy. I'm really excited that we've stayed here and have a chance and continue to build this thing. And he's been a guy that is all about winning that I love coaching. And the guys in the locker room, like Lucas Williamson, that you love coaching. And it's one of the things that I'm most excited about is staying and sustaining this thing at Loyola. And I really feel, you know, we were 7 minutes away from playing for the national championship. And there's no reason why you can't do it at a place like Loyola. And I just think that's guys like Krutwig who are winners are guys you got to recruit.
I mean, Porter, it's amazing to me. I love that response so much. And the reason I love that response so much is, number one, I didn't even have to ask the question, although I did want to reset that and ask you the question. But you brought that up yourself. I was going to say, if I were to be really straight and point blank with it and say exactly what – because I – personally, I feel like you are a great coach and you would have so many opportunities at a really, really high level. That's not to say that you're not doing it at a really high level where you are right now. But if I were to ask you point blank, exactly what is important to you – why are you in it, and can you do it right there? What would you say?
I would say when I was younger, and this applies to a lot of people in different professions, you're so much about the trajectory, like where the end is. Like, I want to win this. I want to get there. I want to get there. And you skip the journey. And as I got older, like that run of the Final Four, it was so meaningful on how we did it and who we did it with. That journey was so big. You know, it's important to me. I want to win. I want to win at a high level, but I love the journey of who I'm with. And I that's been a big part for me. And the other thing, Jim, is that is a factor, because it's not to say I'll never leave, because with the way these at-large bids are going, it's so hard for the Missouri Valleys of the world, the Mountain West of the world, like different conferences, because they all go to the Power Five. And that is frustrating to stay and build it at a place like this. So this year is going to be really telling. And I just think it's great for college basketball. But we're 10 in the net right now. Our offensive efficiency numbers, and we're number one in defense in the country. And so those all, our net is there. So I'm just praying that if we don't win our tournament, we still get that at-large bid, because that'll make people want to build. And what makes the NCAA tournament awesome are the Loyolas of the world. Look what Gonzaga did. They've raised their program so high, and now they're the elite of college basketball. And I just think that's cool for college basketball.
I think that's so key, Porter, what you just said. Like, clearly you're not looking to leave, but you hope that the situation or the system's not set up in a way where you might have to ultimately maybe to get done what you want to get done because of the system and not because of the place where you are, because clearly you like where you are. Now, something you've said, and I'm watching you and your team, it would be easy to say you've got a total buy-in, but that's not necessarily what you're looking for, or not only that, you're looking for also a believe-in. What is the difference between a buy-in and a believe-in?
You know, I think the buy-in, I think the buy-in, just like anything, when the first thing something happens wrong, adversity hits, you know, you can have buyer's remorse. You know, it's like when you buy something, a product, I love it. All of a sudden, it's not working as good. I don't like it anymore. You know, but if you believe in it and you're more invested in it, I think it's harder to give up. I think it's harder to turn when adversity hits. I think it's stronger. And, you know, adversity can really, and you're going to have it. I don't care if it's life. I don't care if it's a sports team. You're going to have it. And I just think when you believe in your cause and you believe in the people in the locker room, you can handle those times so much better and then rise even higher. And I think that's a cool part about, you know, sustaining your culture and having it to where it's a believe in, not a buy in.
We're talking to Porter Moser. You know, Porter, this year you've got a great opportunity right in front of you. I know you're looking ahead, not looking back, but that Final Four trip in 2018 was so magical. It really was the stuff of legend. You, Sister Jean, the program being talked about everywhere. If you were to take a moment just to look back on that season and that run, what kind of thoughts do you have?
You know, it's that stage is awesome. And the people that we went through it with, how we captivated. Jim, when we took over Loyola, we were getting about 50 people at the games. And we kind of just captivated the city of Chicago and actually around the country. And that's really cool. I think they saw our team. You know, a short, real quick story is I'm a known diehard Cubs fan. And in 2016, I was driving down Lakeshore Drive, and the buildings, the skyline was lit up. And in the buildings, it was choreographed. It said, "Go Cubs." And I remember saying, I had chills. Like, that is the coolest thing. And then you fast forward 2 years later, when we beat Kansas State, that night someone texted me the picture. The skyline was lit up maroon and it said, "Go Loyola." And to have that kind of captivation in a sports town like Chicago, where I'm from, was just so cool. But like I said before, the journey, man, the journey of the guys you went with on those teams, you're bound for life. But I will say the last thing is that you get it just like anything in life. When you get something really good, you get a taste of it. You want it again. And I think we're driven. We really want to not necessarily say, I want to go to the Final Four, because we never set out to do that, but we feel we can get in the tournament in advance. We feel like we can do that.
That is an awesome anecdote. I'm glad you shared that story. I kind of got chills hearing that. He is the head basketball coach at Loyola Chicago, 10th season there. And as I mentioned, they're in the top 25 this year for the first time since 85. Big one coming up on CBS Sports Network tomorrow night, 9 p.m. Eastern. Loyola hosting Southern Illinois. Porter, even if I was, and I'm not, I feel good today. I feel good every day. But even if I were dead-ass tired, it was great to talk to you. I need that shot of energy. It's great to have you back, Porter. Thanks so much. Great job.
I'm a big fan. Thanks for having me on, and good catching up with you as well.
All right, so for better or for worse, and I'm going to say mostly for worse, Alvin DeLauro, our regular sound engineer and genius on the board, maintains a fat alarm on deck. The fat alarm is unfortunately exactly what it sounds like. It is an alarm designed to alert the masses that an athlete or a celebrity has blown up. It sounds like this. It's used to alert the masses that somebody has blown up. So it is exactly what its name suggests. It's a fat alarm. Uh-oh, somebody got fat. Now, unlike most of you, I am looking to keep things fair and balanced. And if you're going to make a ghoulish ritual out of laughing at people that you have never met, that you really know nothing about, who may have added a pound or two or 50, then I'm just going to go the other way. And I'm going to shine up the specimens, especially if they themselves went the other way and they transformed from fat to fit. Enter Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Now, Vladdy will be the first to admit that he showed up in 2019 and 2020 looking more like Carl's Jr. than Vlad Jr. Quote, "I came to spring training out of shape for a couple of years. I didn't prepare myself very well, and I felt like my teammates needed an apology from me." End quote. So dude himself said it and was so embarrassed by his look and his lack of commitment that he apologized to his teammates. He owned it. Remember, this guy was supposed to be the next big thing. Unfortunately, he took that literally. Because Vlad Jr. actually lost his spot at third base after booting the ball a team-high 17 times. He gassed out last season. He missed time with a sore knee. He hasn't even left the yard since mid-August. But that was several pounds ago, because Vlad Jr. showed up looking svelte and told the media that he has lost an astonishing 42 pounds. 42. If that's true, and I've got no reason to believe it's not, then that's pretty amazing. And you ask, well, how'd that come to be? Was there a moment? Was there an epiphany? He said, quote, "One day at my house, I just sat down and I thought about all this. I decided right then and there I was going to get ready. I was going to prepare myself. I was going to work very hard for this year. I feel quicker in all aspects of my game right now. Running the bases, I feel great. Before, I would feel a lot of fatigue after taking ground balls. Now I can take 50, 60 ground balls, and I'm feeling good." End of quote. Vladdy, the former fatty. 42 pounds is a big, big number. That's a huge effort. Congrats to my man for shedding all that weight. So I'm here to give Vladdy his love because he did the work. He put it in. He earned it. And I can't wait to see how that shows up between the lines, because this kid's got all the makings of a superstar. We know that. He simply got lost in the sauce. The barbecue sauce. Now, from a slim down dude to the most swole guy ever. Did you all see the video of Browns defensive end Myles Garrett on the basketball court that he dropped yesterday on Twitter? If the answer is no, you got to find it. If the answer is yes, then probably your jaw is like mine, shattered in about 100 different pieces after smashing into the floor. I mean, there are physical specimens, and then there's Myles Garrett. I mean, this dude doesn't even look human at this point. And I mean that in the best way possible. Like, for instance, no disrespect to DK Metcalf, but Myles Garrett in that Hoops mixtape makes DK Metcalf look like, well, me. Look like, well, Wells in the 720. Never mind that Garrett is getting up and down the floor. He's getting up and posterizing fools on a 10-foot hoop. I mean, I can't get past whatever the hell those things are that are hanging off his shoulders. I've seen arms before, but those aren't arms. Those aren't even guns. Those are weapons of mass destruction. You know how we've been on an 11-month shortage of dumbbells nationwide because of the pandemic, and that the pandemic shut down every single gym back in March and nobody could find any weights? Now I know where they all went. I know where every last dumbbell and weight went. Miles Garrett has them and has been lifting every dumbbell, barbell, kettlebell, church bell, and Liberty bell on the planet. Hell, I'm pretty sure this guy could rip a Taco Bell out of its foundation and bench that as well, with the cars in the drive-thru and all. I love the guy wearing a Jurassic Park tank too. My man, I think I'd rather take my chances with every T-Rex that ever walked the face of the earth than get on the wrong side of you. In fact, I'm pretty sure that the T-Rex wants nothing to do with Garrett either. Oh, and remember, we saw it on Hard Knocks. This is the guy that writes poetry, right? He's all about that. How does any pencil or pen not instantly snap into a million little pieces when he goes to grab one or presses on it? And exactly what does his poetry say now? Roses are red, violets are blue. I'm super jacked and I will kill you. The video of this guy getting up and down and in that barn to me is just mesmerizing. It really is. My man either hit the genetic lottery or he's doing all the right things to fuel that system 24/7, 365, or both. He looks absolutely incredible. You know, a lot of times you don't see these guys out of pads. You don't see these guys with their helmet off. You don't see this guy in a local run in a tank top. I mean, he is amazing. And notice that nobody is bothering to play any defense on him at all. Nobody is bothering to step in front of him to take a charge. And can you blame anybody at all? Who the hell is looking to get outlined in chalk on that basketball court? So what I'm getting at is this. While y'all want to kill anybody who gains even a pound or gets a little doughy with it, I'm going to go the other way, and I'm going to give credit where credit is due. Vladdy, for being so much less of a fatty, and for Miles, for being a bleeping monster. Y'all can keep hating. I'm going to just keep hyping, because that's who some of you are, and that's who all of I am is, if that makes sense. I mean, give him some bleeping credit, for real. You're unique and so are your taxes. TurboTax Live is experienced tax experts who listen to you, learn about your unique tax situations, and answer your questions. And on top of all that, they can do your taxes from start to finish. Maybe you began investing and you want some reassurance from an expert that you're doing things the right way. Or maybe now you're self-employed and you need some expert advice on what qualifies as a home office deduction. Or maybe you'd rather have an expert file your taxes for you so you can focus on what matters most. No matter what your situation is, TurboTax Live tax experts can answer all of your questions, give tax advice, review your return before you file, or even do it all for you. TurboTax Live gives you confidence that your uniquely you taxes are done right. Intuit TurboTax Live. File with the help of an expert or let an expert file for you. If you thought that Tom Brady, Brady was the only Tampa Bay Buck absolutely getting over on the entire world right now, think again. He's not. Because Antoine Winfield Jr. is having himself a month. He's having himself a February. Winfield, as you know, plays in the defensive backfield for Tampa Bay in the secondary. And he went all sorts of household late in the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl when the Bucs D hammered the nail in KC's coffin on this 4th and 10.
Incomplete, and Tampa Bay makes another stop. Oh, that taunting action right there by Winfield.
That taunting action by Winfield. You heard Jim Nantz say it. That taunting action by Winfield. That taunting action by Winfield got him flagged. Because dude got right up in Tyreek Hill's face and hit him with the deuces. Like, bro, it's 31-9. It's our ball. There's 4 minutes left. You're cooked. P Peace out, Reek. Thanks for coming. Fly home safely right now. Now, what you did not hear, you only saw it, but you didn't hear why Winfield did it. Why did he do that in that moment? Here's his explanation.
The taunting, man, it's something I just had to do. When we played him earlier, Hill went off on us. He backflipped in front of my face, gave me the peace sign. So it was only right that I gave him the peace sign right back to him. It felt amazing to be able to do that. Not even going to lie.
It's one of my favorite explanations ever. I mean, first of all, complete ownership, no regrets, a smile, a laugh, and the line, quote, "It's just something I had to do." It felt amazing.
It felt amazing to be able to do that. Not even going to lie.
It felt amazing. And I could see where it might. And I agree with the guy. He did have to do it. It's almost like he had no choice. He had to do it. And the reason is Tyreek Hill, as you may recall, hit Winfield with that deuces back in week 12 as he was striding into the end zone, only to stop on the goal line, turn around, and backflip into it. Think about that for a minute. He put up the deuces as he was striding into the end zone, only to stop on a dime at the goal line and backflip over it. I mean, it was savage. Very savage. Take nothing away from Tyreek. It was amazing. But for Winfield to sit on that for a couple of months and then not only get revenge, but get revenge on the most watched telecast of the year at the end of an absolute world championship curb stomping and then hit Tyreek with some of his own medicine, his own taunt from 2 months earlier, I mean, that's just too awesome to hate on, honestly. So Winfield was right. He did have to do it. An opportunity like that comes around maybe once in 10 lifetimes, and there was no way that he was not going to take it. Now, since this is football, and you're not allowed to have a good time, and the NFL oftentimes really does stand for the No Fun League, the suits on Park Avenue in Manhattan made sure that Winfield had a nice little fine sitting in his mailbox. That fine was $8,000. So, if you're Winfield, what do you do about that? Do you push back? Do you appeal? Do you fight that? No. This guy, he took what was an amazing moment, then a moment that became a little less amazing, and then made it five times as amazing. He paid the NFL, paid the fine, but then matched the amount in a donation to a local youth leadership program at a Tampa area middle school, which is awesome. My man turned the best revenge taunt ever into a donation to kids. And it still gets even better than that, because the Bucks saw what he was doing and they threw down as well and they matched his donation. So now that school gets $16,000 from some generous local champions. And then it gets even better because, according to Winfield, a bunch of fans were hitting him up last week asking if they could help pay his fine because they love the taunt so much. Winfield instead directed those same fans to join him and make donations to the school. No, I got this. I did it. I'm the one who threw up the deuces. I'll pay my own fine. But if you really want to help out, take that same money you want to give to me and give it to the school instead. So even more money for the kids. Just an awesome way to spin a super annoying fine for the greatest Super Bowl taunt ever. And well played by everybody involved, especially Winfield. Man, how good must that have felt? Well, he said it. He said it felt incredible. And he had to do it. I mean, it might not have been as savage in a vacuum as Tyreek Hill putting up the deuces and then stopping and backflipping into the end zone. But the fact that it was a revenge taunt on the biggest stage when they shocked the world makes it better. It's better because it went down during the Super Bowl. So I agree, Antoine. That must have felt amazing. Another great player. Josh Heupel is my guest. Josh, good to have you back. How are you?
Doing great, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you on. So I'm kind of curious. It's been about a month, in fact, less than a month, since you were named head coach of Tennessee. What have the first few weeks been like for you?
Been a lot of fun. You're trying to get to know your players here on campus, get to know your roster, and let them have a chance to get to know you, too. And I think that's where you spend a majority of your time and energy. At the same time, you got to get going on recruiting, and we've done that. And then you got to get your staff here. So you put those three balls up in the air, and you're juggling a lot here early. But it's been fun. Knoxville's a great place. The university's got tremendous leadership, and excited about who we have inside of our building and inside of our team room.
Josh Heupel joining us. All right, speaking of fun, I did notice that one of the first things you did with the team was have a huge dodgeball game. What was the thinking, Josh, behind that, and did you see any five-star dodgeball types in that group?
Yeah, I got named all-tournament team. I had a great, great effort, great showing that day. You know, when I got here and just, you know, we had a conversation with our players in the team room, and then met with, you know, some of the leaders, and then had a bunch of just individual meetings with guys. You know, there's two things that kind of struck me, and the first thing that they wanted and felt like they needed was accountability. I think it's rare that a group of 18 to 22-year-olds, that's one of the first things out of their mouth. And the second thing that they wanted was connection. They wanted to spend time together, know each other, and have some fun inside of the building. So it was important to me. You know, we actually had workouts that morning. Guys worked extremely hard, went through agility station, and there's a buffer of time there where there's some dead time before they have to go to class. And you know, so we had a little dodgeball tournament. I think it's important that your players have fun, and important that they get to know us as a staff outside of, you know, just the meeting room and inside the strength and conditioning inside the weight room. It was just a good start to them getting to know us and us getting to know them.
Josh Heupel joining us. I would imagine as head coach, Josh, that's got to be so encouraging to you that when you've got some young guys coming to you and saying, you know, what we want, coach, we want accountability. We want to be held accountable. That's got to be a good thing. So if they're looking for accountability and a connection, I know, knowing you, they're going to get those two things. Now, from our conversations that you and I have had in the past, I know you had a really good thing going at UCF, and obviously we're having a lot of success there. So when this opportunity came up, how did you approach it?
Yeah, UCF's a tremendous university. It's hard to leave anywhere at any point just because, you know, the love that you have for your players that are inside of that locker room, the time and energy you spent in recruiting them, developing them, getting to know them, and the common experiences that you've had. To me, in coming here, this is one of the top, it's one of the premier logos in all of college football. When you think of college football, Tennessee and the brand is naturally going to come to your mind, the steep tradition that they've had here. And then you look at the opportunity to rebuild it and combine the great legacy and the great past with a new age approach. And then you add in the fact that just the leadership here on campus with our chancellor, obviously my familiarity with Danny White, the athletic director, the alignment that they have with me as far as how you want to build a sustainable championship caliber program, it was an opportunity that was too good to pass up.
Josh Heupel joining us. Of course, those who don't know, Danny White had been the AD at UCF as well. You know, one way of describing things is the way that Rashard Kazi, who played for UCF, described it to The Athletic. He said, quote, "He let our nuts hang, man. He let us be us." End of quote. I thought that was an amazing quote and a great way to describe it. How important is it to you to let your guys be themselves?
Really important. I think you have to have fun. You're going to have to work really hard. You got to put a ton of time and energy into this game, but there's no reason that you can't have fun walking into this building with the guys that you love to be around. And then when you get a chance to go play on game day, you got to let your players go play. You recruit great players. You develop them. And then you let them go out there and enjoy the competitive arena that they're in and let them go try to win and play free. And it's important to me that we do that. We got a staff that believes that as well, energetic, engaging, great teachers. And we're going to recruit great players and let them go play on game day, man.
So, Josh, what about Tennessee? Like, it's easy to remember the days when Tennessee football was running off bowl wins, top 10 finishes, but there have been some lean years since then. You know the pride and the passion that fan base has, how badly they want it. What's it going to take to get Tennessee football back to where it used to be?
This is the flagship program inside of the state. The passion and energy that surrounds our program 365 days out of the year is unmatched anywhere in college football. You know, that's why they have a 103,000 seat stadium. And, you know, for me, the great passion and energy for me has always been in being in a place where you're building something, you're creating something. That's what we're doing here. This is a tradition that is as deep as anywhere in the country. We get an opportunity to rebuild that, but do it with a new age approach and put a product out there that I think is going to be extremely exciting. It's going to be an aggressive style of football on offense and defense, different than maybe what the approach has been here in the recent past. And we get to recruit to that. We get to develop our players, and then we get to go have a heck of a lot of fun on Saturday.
All right, so I think you answered it in large part right there. But when you talk about recruiting, when you're recruiting, what type of a player are you looking for, and what is your message to recruits about Tennessee football and what they're going to get if they show up?
The message to Tennessee football is that we're going to be the most aggressive team on the field every Saturday. That's offense, it's defense. It's the way we approach everything that we're doing inside of our building. But we're going to let those guys go play on Saturday. You know, Tim Banks comes from Penn State, top five in so many defensive categories, in particular causing havoc, sacks, turnovers. That's who and what we're going to be. You get a chance to recruit great players and then let them go do those things. And the same thing on the offensive side of the football. You're going to spread people out, play with tempo, apply pressure to defenses, create one-on-one opportunities, and then allow our guys to go win. When you combine that approach philosophically on the football side of it, scheme-wise, and then combine that with an approach of doing it the right way and allowing our players to have fun during the process, I think it's going to be really enticing to recruits.
Josh Heupel is joining us for a few more moments. You know, you've mentioned it being a new age approach a couple of times, and then you mentioned scheme. You know, I'm curious, when we talk about the success that you had at UCF, especially when it comes to offensive football, you did bring four assistants with you from the offensive side from UCF. So what kind of an offense are you looking to run in Knoxville, for instance? Is it a matter of just plug and play, or does it feel like you have to change it up a little?
You're going to change from year to year in what you're doing. Our overall philosophy will not change as far as trying to apply pressure, playing with tempo, trying to create matchups that give opportunities for guys to go win. But you're going to change based on your personnel. And I think that's been true of, you know, when we were in Missouri and led this league in offense for 2 years, we had a certain style of who we were based on our personnel. Went to UCF. It changed subtly year to year, in particular with the different quarterbacks that we played with, but then our skill guys as well. You have to adjust and put your kids in a position of success. You know, first team meeting, I told our players, if we got three great tight ends, we'll play with three tight ends on the field. We'll play with five wideouts if that's our best personnel package. At the end of the day, our players are responsible to show that they're going to play at a championship level. They do that. It's our responsibility as coaches to find a way to put them in a position and get them on the football field to go be successful.
So, Josh, one last thought. Another part of this, of course, is you're returning to the SEC. You were the offensive coordinator and quarterback coach at Missouri. What's it mean to you to return to that conference, and how motivated are you by that challenge?
Absolutely. You know, you just look at the draft. You look at just win percentages of coaches in here. This is the toughest, most competitive league in America, an opportunity for myself or our staff to go prove that every single week. It's the types of kids that you recruit here, man. The kids that are sitting in that team room are really good football players that believe and are extremely prideful in who they are individually. And we're going to build a collectiveness or a collective attitude of connectedness and belief that we're going to be able to go out and be successful each week because of the work that we put into it, and excited about that challenge here coming up next fall.
A new era, a new opportunity, a new challenge at Tennessee. They've got a new head coach. He was named head coach on January 27th. Tennessee is going to open up on September 4th against Bowling Green. Make a note of that. Josh Heupel is their coach. Josh, great to have you back on the show. I appreciate that. I look forward to you and I having a lot of conversations about Tennessee football going forward. Nice to have you, Josh. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Jim.
Good friend of the program, Jonathan Jones. Jonathan, good to have you back. What's up? How are you?
Happy to be back, man. How are you?
Good, good, dude. Great to have you. Thanks so much. Let me start first by asking you about the Steelers. President Art Rooney II issued a statement, Jonathan, yesterday that he and Ben Roethlisberger met. They had a productive meeting. He wants to come back. The statement also mentioned that the next step is to work out his contractual situation. So what do you take away from that notion that they have to work out that contract? What's that mean for Ben as it relates to the Steelers and their cap?
Yeah, I mean, they've known that they were going to have to work it out because him going into the 2021 season, if they wanted him back at a cap hit of $41.25 million, that was untenable. That was never going to happen. And so, you know, this has never really been about, hey, let's figure out the contract. Very clearly, over the last couple of weeks, the Steelers had to figure out if they wanted Ben Roethlisberger back or not, because if they did want him back and they knew that, then, yeah, of course they have to figure out the contract situation. And, you know, we've understood that the cap, whether the floor was at 175, obviously just got bumped up to 180, and it may squeak up to 182 or 183. But the Steelers knew that they had to get that $41.25 million cap hit down. And so they should have been working at that for a while. Certainly they have been working at that for a while. But I think the Steelers, from the very top of the organization down, had to figure out whether they wanted Ben Roethlisberger back or not. And it took them several weeks to figure that out.
I was going to say, that to me is the key point, right? So where do you come out on that? Do they want him back? I mean, obviously on some level. Let me put it to you another way. If he did not want to come back, do you get the sense that maybe they would not have been that upset about that?
To that last question, I don't think that they would have been too banged up about it. But then what do the Steelers do? Because you have to have a number of contingencies in place at that point. You're going to have to figure out, one, how you get that cap hit down. Do you want to be competitive in 2021, or do you want to have a hard reset? And I don't necessarily mean tank. I don't know if that is in the DNA of the Pittsburgh Steelers or not. But do you send a third-round pick to the New York Jets to get Sam Darnold and try to go 10-6 again and keep that no losing season under Mike Tomlin streak alive? Or do you say, all right, guys, we're just going to have to get caught up with the cap this year? So I think that would have triggered a whole new set of contingencies for the Steelers that surely they were kicking around until Art Rooney and everyone else in the organization said, you know what, let's bring Ben back one more time.
Jonathan Jones is joining us. All right, Jonathan, what about Juju Smith-Schuster? Do you expect him to be in Pittsburgh next season?
You know, it goes back to the cap, and it's just really hard to figure out how he's going to fit under their cap. And, you know, you look elsewhere, and they obviously just lost Pouncey at center. It's hard to imagine they want to lose Villanueva at left tackle, but he's an unrestricted free agent. They're going to have to pay him, especially if they're bringing Ben Roethlisberger back. You can't lose your two best offensive linemen up there in what is most likely going to be Big Ben's final season. And so once you start seeing where the money's going, and yeah, you're going to have to extend TJ Watt at some point, no time in the next couple of weeks, but you're probably going to have to extend Minka Fitzpatrick as well. I don't know where you're going to get the $14, $15, $16 million for Juju Smith-Schuster. And then finally, the fact is that once he became that number one wide receiver, he wasn't nearly as productive as everyone wanted him to be. And so for all of those reasons, I think that he's out of Pittsburgh.
Jonathan Jones joining us, which brings me to J.J. Watt. And you just laid it out a couple of times about the challenges involving the cap. What about J.J. Watt then? Like, what's the market for him? And what kind of a contract realistically do you think he can expect to receive?
Well, that's a great question. And I think J.J. Watt right now, and I wrote this last week for CBSSports.com, I think that the longer he waits, I think the more it's going to seem to be about money, that he wants to, you know, he cares about appearances. He doesn't want to seem like some washed up has been, and he's not. He played very well last season. He's not the three-time defensive player of the year that he was in the middle part of last decade, but he's still a quality pass rusher in the NFL. Now, what's his contract going to be? I have a really hard time thinking that a team is actually going to pay him $16 million per year in straight-up money. Could it get to 16 if he, you know, becomes an all-pro and gets, you know, 15 sacks in 2021? Sure. But if that was going to be the case, then why didn't a team just trade for him at his cap hit of $17.5 million in 2021, send a sixth-round pick to the Texans? Hard for me to believe that number is going to get up there. I do think that the real contract if you forget about incentives, is really going to look closer to a Calais Campbell deal with the Baltimore Ravens. That was 2 years, $25 million. So we're talking about $12.5 million per season. I think that that's where it's going to be for Watts, rather than getting into the mid to high teens.
Jonathan Jones is joining us. Jonathan, one more thought about J.J. Watt. Like, to your point, he's not what he used to be, but he's still a really effective player, and he's been such a force in that league for so long. He seems to be a really well-respected teammate, but is there any concern at all about how he might fit into a new locker room?
There absolutely is. And, you know, listen, this is a guy, Walter Payton Man of the Year, fantastic humanitarian. We know about all of his efforts down in Houston over the years and certainly during the hurricane and the flooding there. But, you know, I talked with several sources around the league about him the last couple of weeks, and there is, I don't want to say a concern, people aren't staying up at night wondering this, but they do have a question about, hey, you dominated that locker room, and then when Deshaun Watson became the franchise quarterback, you obviously dominated the defense. Everyone looked to you. How are you going to fit in a Green Bay where this is Aaron Rodgers' team? Are you going to try to bring a mentality to the Buffalo Bills where, you know, they were a pass rush on Patrick Mahomes away from making it to the Super Bowl? You look at the Titans and, like, is what worked for you in Houston and has worked for you the last decade, is that going to work for you with slightly diminished skills now in your plus 30 season? So that's a question that teams have, and obviously he's going to have to answer that as he looks for a suitor.
Jonathan Jones is joining us. I appreciate your thoughts there. Jonathan, what about, and there's more and more information trickling out. We see an Athletic report about Russell Wilson. He stormed out of an offensive meeting because he felt like his offensive input was not valued. Like, what do you make of his situation there, and what's his end game? What's he hoping to change?
I don't really know what his ultimate end game is. If he wants more say in the offense, well, you know, he's had a pretty great deal of say as it relates to NFL quarterbacks. It's hard for me, if you look at the last couple years in the league, to find a team that has catered more to the quarterback than Seattle has with Russell Wilson. Yes, you can say Tampa Bay with Tom Brady. I think that's a bit of a different situation. I think you can look at Pittsburgh and how they've tailored that offense around Ben Roethlisberger and his deficiencies and what he has become. But really, outside of that, you look at the defensive additions that they've made. You look at their free agent acquisitions. You wanted some tight ends, they went out and got some tight ends. Want a defensive playmaker? Hey, we'll send two first-round picks. We'll overpay for a safety. You know, we'll get you the weapons on offense. We'll try to improve the offensive line. And very clearly, this offensive line, while not breaking any records this past season, was better this past season than it really has been in the last few years. And listen, you want them to cook? Okay, go out there and throw the ball around a whole bunch. But then teams are going to adjust. And how do you readjust off of that? And then the Seahawks didn't. And frankly, Jim, I've talked about this before, but everyone says he's never had an MVP vote. Well, first of all, in what year were you going to vote for Russell Wilson over Cam Newton in 2015 or Tom Brady in 2017? The list can go on and on. There's only one vote. But every single year, Russell hits a lull for 2-3. This season, it was really like four games where he took himself out of the MVP voting. This is not an aberration. This happens every year. That's not to say he's not a top five quarterback in the NFL. He certainly is, in my opinion. But you go to the playoffs 8 and 9 years, you know, you just can't beat a Rams team with John Wolford and a quarterback who doesn't have an opposable thumb, despite getting 14 possessions to win that playoff game. You know, maybe in all of this stuff, you can also hold yourself a little bit accountable. And then finally, you look at the teams that he's thinking about joining. I mean, the Raiders haven't had a top half of a defense in the league in the last, what, 17 years or so. You look at Mike McCarthy in Dallas, and Aaron Rodgers says, yeah, okay, go ahead and join him down there. The Saints make sense to me because of the offense, but they can't figure out their cap. So I don't really know what Russell wants, and I would love to know exactly what he wants.
Jonathan Jones, my guest. Listen, I wish I had more time for this topic, but I want to get it in here. You've got a piece up on the Women's Careers in Football Forum, which took place this week. This was your first time sitting in that forum. What did you take away from that experience?
I thought it was a fantastic sort of forum that the NFL has given to 40 very deserving participants, female participants, and 30 of those 40 were women of color as they're trying to find their foothold in the NFL, be it coaching or scouting or in the front office. I thought there was an amazing amount of advice given from head coaches, general managers, current coaches, assistant coaches who are women in the NFL, and really advice that transcends football. It talks about passion for your industry and your craft, and it talks about you know, how you need to hey, you haven't played football? Okay, call up the local high school and try to watch film with the coaches there, or get in on these clinics as we are in this Zoom world. I thought there was some really incredible advice, and you can find that entire panel online at NFL.com, but also, of course, I wrote about it, as you mentioned, Jim, on CBSSports.com.
All right, so really quickly, Jonathan, as a follow, that the number of assistant coaches went from 2 to 8. Does that increase mean that it's only a matter of time before women are serving as coordinators, even head coaches?
I think, and Brian Flores mentioned this, we're certainly closer to it now than we were 2 to 5 years ago. You know, 5 years ago, there were zero women coaches in the NFL. I do think that we're still a really far way away from that. There still has to be an intentionality by those who are hiring. There's still going to have to be acceptance across locker rooms. And so, I don't want to rain on anyone's parade, but I think that in reality, we're still several years away from really getting to that point. But I am certainly heartened and encouraged by where we are, certainly compared to just as recently as 2 or 3 years ago.
Right. Let's go to Illinois, Gavin. It's good to have you, Gavin. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good, Jim. How about you?
Good, good. What's up?
Hey, so I'm a first-time caller, so I'm just going to get straight to the point, shoot my shot here. First of all, the Lakers are toast without Anthony Davis. LeBron is not even close to the same LeBron from his second stint with the Cavs. Anthony Davis is not going to fix the problems with the Lakers because Frank Vogel sucks. Frank Vogel is just one of LeBron's puppets. And Martin Gasol looks like he should be playing in the community rec league.
That's not a good call. No. You don't like that call.
Hey, Gavin.
I don't like that call.
You know what sucks?
Not a very good call.
That call.
Good night!